Next, we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. And this week, there was a particularly poignant story that caught our eye about someone who found his life's work, but whose body is slowly robbing him of the ability to do it. We're talking about Richard Thompson, the creator of Cul-de-Sac, a daily comic strip syndicated to some 150 papers worldwide. The strip features a preschool girl named Alice Otterloop and her interactions with family and friends who share her cul-de-sac in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. The profile of cartoonist Richard Thompson was written by Michael Kavna, a style editor and comics blogger for the Washington Post, and he's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios along with Richard Thompson, the creator of Cul-de-sac. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for
having me. I guess I should admit that I am a huge fan. I should spirit of full disclosure, I should tell everybody I'm a huge fan.
Bless your heart.
So, Richard Thompson, can you tell us, how did you get the idea for Cul-de-sac?
I was doing a weekly cartoon for the Washington Post called Richard's Poor Almanac, and my editor there switched the magazine back in, 2001 maybe, Tom Schroeder, and he said, would you ever think about doing a weekly, like a comic strip with continuing characters? I thought, well, I thought about that one time when I was 20 years old, maybe.
Plus, it's intimidating. I mean, you got to do it every day. It's like,
well,
got to be every day.
It was for Sunday only at the time for the Post magazine. But I thought about it for, I think it took us about 2 years of me thinking about it before he convinced me it was possible.
And Michael, Richard, I'm not going to ask you this because I'm sure you're a little too modest to talk about this. But this is a strip that other comic strip artists love.
Absolutely.
And what do they love about it? In fact, in your piece, you were able to get an interview, a very rare interview, with the renowned comic strip writer Bill Watterson, who's viewed as the J.D. Salinger of comics. He's the creator of the retired strip Calvin and Hobbes, and he apparently does not give interviews, and he granted only the second interview post-retirement to you to talk about Richard Thompson. So what do other artists love about this strip?
Well, a couple things. Now, we'll say I was grateful to Mr. Watterson. Yeah, my understanding is it was only a second interview in 22 years, and I got very much the sense from Bill Watterson that he sees Richard as a kindred spirit, someone who knows how to sort of pour his soul into a comic strip and create, isn't just always going for gags, but is going for depth, is knows how to use the panel, knows how to create, characters that come alive.
But what is the public like about it, too? That's what the professionals like about it. What do you think the public responds to?
Well, I think it is Richard's take on childhood. You know, he brings it down to a child's eye level and observed closely. And that's, of course, as universal as it was in Peanuts. With Richard, what we get is he captures childhood, both the universal and the individual. It's both. We can recognize common things and also what adults can recognize about how parents act when we see them. And the other factor is, though, there's a Richard's individual quirkiness, and I mean that in the best way, how he observes it, and he brings his own special take to that.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. That's Michael Kavna you just heard. He's the author of a Washington Post magazine profile of Richard Thompson, who's the artist and author of the syndicated comic strip Cul-de-sac. They're both here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. And now to the pain part. I understand that, Mr. Thompson, you were diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Was that a big shock?
It was kind of a relief in some ways. At the same time, I thought, Jesus, you're in for a haul with this thing. So timing in comedy is everything. My timing on this was, pretty exquisitely off. So.
Because?
Well, as soon as I hit the syndication deal, it's like things start sliding downhill. So it's been manageable enough, but
One of the effects of Parkinson's disease is loss of motor control, which is crucial to drawing.
Oh, yeah.
How are you coping with that?
Well, it hasn't really hit my right hand so much. And my left arm is pretty lousy, but I'm right-handed. And when I'm concentrating on a drawing, a lot of the symptoms seem to kind of disappear. I think it's their mental tricks you can play on yourself to, fend off a lot of the symptoms of it, I think.
One of the poignant things about this is that it's, if you don't mind my putting it this way, you've been recognized as a freelance illustrator, but to come to this level of prominence in your field, you came to it rather late.
Yeah.
One might argue. Is there a part of you that feels cheated in a way?
And not so much cheated, but I just thought, I should have done this 20 years ago, but it's my own fault. So, but, I don't think 20 years ago I could have done whatever it is I'm doing now. So I don't know. I think if I tried to do a comic strip 20 years ago, it would not have been about children. I fooled around with some ideas for one 30 years ago, maybe when I was in my 20s, and just, you know, put them aside because they were kind of lame and silly. And just, you know, you look at your stuff and you think, I was always my own strongest critic, which is a good thing and a bad thing. But, I felt like, you know, I think I popped through a window of opportunity that was very briefly open, and, you know, I feel lucky for that.
Michael?
I wanted to say, I do think there's something critical about how Richard, when he came along, you know, on one hand, as I wrote in the piece, you can feel cheated, like Mr. Watterson and others, you know, broke through in their 20s, Charles Schultz and others. But on the other hand, as I talked to Richard over a matter of months and talked to other his editors and other people, it was such a natural progression where he was an award-winning illustrator in the mid-90s, but it was as if he were, you know, like a professor accumulating knowledge. And when you see it unfold, it was almost like everything was pointing toward this sort of preparation. So on one hand, I could see how Richard feel cheated. On the other hand, I don't think it would be cul-de-sac if there hadn't been this very gradual progression. And you look back at his work and you see evolution every step of the way.
And also the life experience. You know, you're a parent yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You've got that life, you know, you live the life.
Things you notice that you would otherwise never have seen.
What's next for you? Are you going to continue to be able to draw?
I think, well, for a while, I'm sure, at least. It's,
what's,
you know,
a while?
It's, I don't know. Could be. I was at my doctor's last week, and he said, you know, things are going okay. It's, you know, degenerative disease, but, you know, who can say? Michael J. Fox is going strong, and he's had it for 20-some years. So, you know, and, you know, advances are being made, changes are, you know, it's one of those things where strides are being made, and who knows if there's a cure in sight, but it's, you know, symptoms are treatable in ways that they were not treatable 5 years ago. So it's, you know, who can say?
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Our best wishes to you.
Thank you.
And have you heard about
And Michael
his Kavner, team?
Hold on a second. Yeah. You wanted to, there's a final thought from you. I understand that Mr. Thompson is also has been nominated for a very special award, and we'll find out in a matter of days whether he's won it. Tell us about that.
Yeah. This Saturday, the National Cartoonist Society gets together in Boston, and this is a peer award. This is where your colleagues decide who was the best cartoonist of that year. And this is the second straight year that Richard has been nominated, and it's fairly amazing. And I should say he's also doing this Team Cul-de-Sac effort, which is, you know, they're trying to raise. The deadline is June 15th for cartoonists to submit, but there'll be an auction and a book. And they're trying to raise, through Michael J. Fox's fundraising arm, $250,000 for Parkinson's research. So they're sometimes, you know, out of left field, other turns come out of this.
Yeah. Michael Kavner is the Comics Riffs blogger for The Washington Post. He's the author of a profile of Richard Thompson, the artist and author of the syndicated comic strip Cul-de-Sac. They both joined us in our Washington, D.C. studio. And if you want to read the piece in its entirety, we hope you will. We'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Richard Thompson, Michael Kavner, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. After some 5,000 episodes, a cultural phenomenon comes to an end. Of course, we're talking about The Oprah Winfrey Show, which airs its last episode this Wednesday. Oprah's first national show aired on September 8th, 1986, and featured a segment on how to marry the man or woman of your choice. But since then, the show has gone on to win many awards, launch careers, sent books onto the bestseller lists, and touched the lives of countless viewers here in the U.S. and, in fact, around the world. Let's listen to a clip of Oprah reflecting on the relationship she's built with her audience.
Our viewers have enriched my life beyond all measure. And you all have graciously invited me into your living rooms, into your kitchens, and into your lives. And for some of you, longtime Oprah viewers, you have literally grown up with me. We've grown together.
Over the course of the next couple of days, we are going to reflect on the phenomenon that is Oprah. To do that, we're going to check in with some of the people whose lives and careers have been changed by working with her directly and who know her well. And we're going to begin today with another person who's been elevated to one name status. We're talking about Dr. Phil. He has a full name, of course. It's Philip McGraw. He's a psychologist, a best-selling author, host of the syndicated talk show Dr. Phil, where he remains after 9 years the second most popular talk show host in the country, behind Oprah, of course. And Dr. Phil joins us now from his home office in Los Angeles. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
You know, I can't resist. We've only just met, but I want to ask you, what are your feelings on this momentous occasion?
Well, this is a real change in people's lives. I've often said that when Oprah goes off the air, I think it's going to be like, think about you live in a neighborhood and you have a really great friend across the fence or around the corner, and every day, like 3 or 4 o'clock, they come over and you all drink coffee and you talk about things that matter to the two of you. And that's just a big part of your life. And then one day she says, I'm moving away. I'm sorry, but I'm moving a couple thousand miles away. I won't be here every day. And there's like this emptiness, this huge void. And I think that's what's going to happen. Now, I mean, clearly, Oprah has the network, and I think people will follow her there. But this is the end of an era, and for many people, it'll be the end of a relationship.
Well, what about for you, though? As I understand it, you are still very dear friends. The two of you are very good friends. But is it your show is going to continue? Is it a change for you? Is it a loss for you? Is there some sadness for you?
Well, you know, in a unique situation because we are very close friends and we continue to work together. And she's always been my mentor and helper on the Dr. Phil show. And, of course, that will continue. And then I'm very involved in the Oprah Winfrey Network doing a number of projects. So I'm one of those lucky few that gets to continue to have her in my life on an ongoing basis. So I feel very fortunate about that.
Now, you met her when many people might remember this, but in case some people don't, back in 1996, the beef industry threw defamation claims at her after she had done a program warning about the possible sort of health risks associated with beef. And then you became, you know, friends in the course of that trial. Why did you decide to work with you? You had a very, you know, established career before then. You're doing your own thing. You were in private practice. You were had a specific specialty. But what made you want to pursue this adventure with her?
Well, that's a really good question. And you're right. I was on her defense team up in Amarillo, Texas, and I got to know her really well because I worked with her for a couple of years, actually, leading up to that trial. And then during the trial, we lived together, a small group of us lived together in a bed and breakfast out on the edge of town for almost 2 months, as I recall. And so she's my ex-roommate. We all lived out there together. And I really got to know her well, and we became very dear friends as we are today. And I had no designs whatsoever on ever having a career in television. You're quite right. I had worked in the field of psychology and had a trial consulting firm and loved what I was doing. But then she called and said, look, you really told me how it was during that trial, and that candor made a huge difference, not only in the outcome of the trial, but the way I felt about it. I want you to come on and do the same with my viewers. And I said, well, I don't know, maybe. At first I said, nah, I was actually going out of the country. And I said, I think I'll pass. But then the producer said, look, we'll wait till you get back and do it. I thought, okay, you know, why not? Give it a shot. And I will say this about Oprah, Michelle, and I thought it was really speaks volumes about her. I said at the time, look, all I can do is what I think is right for the person I'm talking to. And maybe that'll make good television and maybe it won't. But I'm not going to say anything that I don't think is exactly right, regardless of what impact it might have on the program. And she said, I wouldn't have it any other way. They've got to come first. And, you know, we don't want to do anything just for television purposes. Do what you think is right at the time and we'll see how it works out. And as the old saying goes, I guess the rest is history.
I'll play a clip of Oprah Winfrey describing your contributions to the program. Here it is.
He gave us more aha moments than we could count.
You talked about flowers and cake and wedding and dress. You're preparing for the wedding, but not for the marriage.
Mercy, that is a good statement. That is so good.
People say time heals all wounds. Let me tell you, time heals nothing. You can do the wrong thing for 10 years, and it doesn't equal the right thing for one day. The fact
Ooh, that's good, Phil.
Can I just say this? How's that working for you?
Have you ever heard anybody be more enthusiastically supportive of what you have to say? And nobody could pull that off but Oprah.
You know, but to that point, one of the things that you are known for is making the mental health field accessible. One of the things I think people credit Oprah Winfrey for is making mental health issues and seeking mental health support, democratizing that, making it accessible, making it less scary. And I wonder if you feel there's still a need for that. And what is the next frontier that needs to happen in this area to extend that work, even if Oprah's not going to be there to help participate? Well, she's in her own network, but do you see my question?
Well, I do. And look, there's so much work to be done. I started the Dr. Phil Show 9 years ago. We're just finishing our ninth season. And I actually looked at one of the interviews I did right before we went on the air for the first time. I looked at it just the other day, and I said in that interview that what we wanted to do was talk about the silent epidemics in America, the things that need attention but don't get it. And it's interesting that in this ninth season, we really, really focused on the silent epidemics. We began a campaign called End the Silence on Domestic Violence and really worked on trying to bring into center stage, into the bright light, the fact that this is one of the most underreported crimes in our society today. We have a major campaign on anti-bullying. We work very hard on that. Teen pregnancy. A lot of these things that go on that people don't talk about in polite society, and I think they do need to be talked about. And one of the things I'm proudest of is that I think we have advanced the dialogue on mental health in America and mental illness in America. Of course, you know, the Dr. Phil Show, I think, is the first and probably still the only show that is completely devoted to mental health issues. And I think the fact that it's successful speaks to the need.
What do you think Oprah's legacy will be? And understanding that she is going to continue with the Oprah Winfrey Network, but that is not accessible to everybody. You have to have cable and everyone does not. So what do you think for this chapter of her life, what do you think her legacy will be?
Well, I think she has legitimized the format. You know, I think there are so many shows, particularly in this day and time of reality television, and we've got such a voyeuristic and narcissistic element to our society where people think they need an audience for brushing their teeth. I mean, with YouTube and everything on the internet. And I think what she's done is said, look, there's a way to do this right. There's a way to do this with a responsible dialogue and not sensationalism. And I think that has really defined it. And it set the standard for me. I mean, she is the gold standard in television. And I grew up in that realm, and she, you know, she taught me from the beginning, you know, do it right or don't do it, and you don't have to go for the cheap thrill to be successful.
And you were worried at all, though, that this genre, because of the success of her show and then the success of your show, that it has spawned a genre where people are going to continue to up the ante, if for no other reason than to distinguish themselves from you, in which you're not sure what kind of advice people are actually getting, whether they really are cared for after they have these very searing experiences exposed. Do you ever worry about that?
Well, I do, and I think that people people look sometimes at the tip of the iceberg, Michelle. I think, for example, on our show, we have an advisory board that's made up of the top minds in psychology, psychiatry, medicine. I mean, I have I think we have like 15, 16 people on our advisory board, and I have two past presidents of the American Psychological Association, a professor emeritus from Stanford University, the head of the family division from the Harvard Medical School, Dr. John Turbin, all of these different people from the top learning centers around the country, University of Texas, UCLA, all these places. And whenever we do a show, I send that topic and oftentimes guest information to some or all of our advisory board, and they give me input. They give me feedback. Hey, Dr. Phil, here's a new study that isn't even published yet. Here's what's going on with evidence-based treatment in this area. And so we take all of that into account when I go on stage and start saying the things to the guests that I do. And then we have a 100% aftercare program, resource program, where when our guests go home to Omaha or Seattle or Poughkeepsie, then we provide them support in their community with professionals there. And so there's a lot that doesn't meet the eye. And I think most people aren't willing to do all of that. And I think that's what you have to do it right.
Well, finally, we only have about 30 seconds left. And you've already told us a little bit about what you can continue to work on. But what are you most excited about going forward, even as we are all mourning the loss of Oprah, at least for this chapter?
Well, you know, I think we're going to continue to do it right. And Oprah will continue to be in people's lives. She has her magazine and her network. And I can just say this, she taught me well, and I intend to make her proud.
All right. Dr. Phil is the host and executive producer of the popular syndicated television show Dr. Phil, which launched in 2002. And he, of course, was known for his association with Oprah Winfrey. Her over-the-air network show is ending this week. And as she shifts her focus to her own work on cable, you can expect to see Dr. Phil there in a series called Finding Sarah that involves the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, and Ask Oprah's All-Stars. And Dr. Phil was kind enough to join us from his home office in Los Angeles. Dr. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Have a wonderful day.
And now some music to try to soothe us as we get over the loss of Oprah. It's our regular segment we call In Your Ear. That's where some of our guests share the music that inspires them. Today we have contributions from a musical duo, saxophonist Jacques Schwartz-Bart and vocalist Stephanie McKay. They are also husband and wife. We recently had them on the program to talk about the latest album from Schwartz-Bart titled Rise Above. They told us what they listen to when they aren't on stage.
Hi, I'm Stephanie McKay.
I'm Jacques Schwartz-Bart.
And this is what's playing in our ear.
I've been listening to this collaboration between Bobby McFerrin and the Yellow Jackets. And there is one tune that's absolutely stupendous that's called Remembrance. It's a combination of cold and hot. It's so smooth in one way and organized and structured, but at the same time, it has an air and light feeling to it. It's like hearing the wind blow, you know, somewhere far away, and it just takes me for a trip every time.
Well, a lot of what I'm listening to right now is our toddler songs, nursery rhymes.
Greetings, Kermit the Frog here, and today I'd like to tell you a little bit about the color green. Do you know what's green?
Particularly Sesame Street and Kermit the Frogs. It's not easy being green.
You see, frogs are green, and I'm a frog. And that means I'm green, you see? It's not that easy being green. Having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it could be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that.
I would have to say that's what's in my ear, and I'm not ashamed to say it because these are classic songs written by the great composer Joe Raposo.
It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things.
A song by Branford Marsalis called In the Crease. It's one of the best modern jazz compositions that I've heard in a long time. On one hand, it's very abstract, but it's rooted in that historic tradition of jazz that the Marsalis brothers are known to embrace. For all those extremes that it reconciles somehow, I just love it.
Mm-hmm.
Julie London's Lover Man, her interpretation of that, or her interpretation of any song she sings, really.
I don't know why, but I'm feeling so sad. I long to try something I've never had. Never had no kissing. Ooh, what I've been missing. Lover man, oh, where can you be?
I love listening to her because of her intimacy, how she can draw the listener in, and you feel like she's singing just to you.
I'd give my soul just to call you my own. Got a moon above me, but no man loved me. Lover man, oh, where can you be?
That was saxophonist Jacques Schwartz Bart and vocalist Stephanie McKay telling us what's playing in their ears. To hear more from them and our previous conversations about music, go to our website, npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
That you make love to me. Strange as it seems, someday we'll meet, and you'll dry all my tears, then whisper sweet.
Every week, 7 million people tuned in to Oprah. Her departure, along with the decline of soap operas, leave a huge hole in daytime television. And as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, nobody seems to know what's going to happen next.
If you really want to find out about daytime TV, go to a nail salon where at least one TV is on all the time.
Thank you for letting me be here. It's wonderful to see you two together.
Like Patsy's Nail Bar in Washington, D.C., where receptionist Crystal Jones controls the remote. She says she puts on what the clients want to watch.
We go from Ellen to Oprah to the Cash Cab.
The Cash Cab is a reality show on Discovery. Crystal Jones says she's often riveted by some of Oprah Winfrey's interviews, and now she has to figure out how to replace her.
There is going to be a big empty space. I've noticed that we'll watch movies or we'll watch those shows where they do the makeovers, what not to wear and stuff like that instead.
What not to wear is on cable. Unlike 25 years ago when the Oprah Winfrey show began, viewers today will have many more places to look for something else to watch when she's gone. Discovery hopes they'll switch to Oprah's new cable network, OWN. Crystal Jones says she's tried it, but so far it's not the best fit for a nail salon. One recent Saturday, they were running a marathon of Oprah's Women in Jail series.
That's a little bit much. Nobody wants to see that while they're getting their pedicures.
Now, if Crystal Jones is having trouble figuring out what to put on in Patsy's nail salon, imagine what it's like for station managers who are about to lose the most popular show in the 4 p.m. time slot. Larry Gerbrandt is an analyst for Media Valuation Partners.
The local station manager is the one most directly on the line because he needs to generate a certain level of ratings to deliver to advertisers.
Daunting is how one station manager put the prospect of filling the Oprah void. There are certainly some contenders being bandied about, Katie Couric, Anderson Cooper, or they could move Ellen DeGeneres or Dr. Oz into that spot.
No clear winners have emerged, and certainly nobody has swept the deck.
The other big sea change taking place on daytime TV, ABC canceled One Life to Live and All My Children.
The thing I want more than anything is to take my life back, Jack.
Wow, Erica looks great. And fans are not happy about her going away. Last week, they protested in New York. Fans even urged Oprah Winfrey to bring them to OWN. She videotaped a message saying she felt their pain.
I understand. I understand the loyalty. I understand the sense of disappointment. I felt this way when Mary Tyler Moore went off the air, I must say.
But even Oprah can't save the soaps. Their audiences have declined. But more importantly, the broadcast networks can save money by filling those time slots with talk or reality shows. Even though broadcast TV has the bigger audience numbers, the programming is looking more and more like cable all the time. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.